at the town and is now in the possession of the army.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed the exact same spot the whole time. They're outside, I can say that.
Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Come on, Lisa, are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular pit. UFOs over New York,
and I ain't too surprised. Well, the thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I'd gone.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me there'd be days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange day indeed. Most peculiar, mama. Roll!
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello and welcome to edition 441 of Strange Days Indeed. This week, the 4th in May 2007, our editorial contributor Dave Furlott, British UFO researcher author Dr. David Clark, and a reprise of an interview that was broadcast on the radio version of SDI back in August 2003 with Anne Druffel about her book on James McDonald, Firestorm. And every week we ask you for feedback, and sure enough, it trickles in. This one from Bubba, Errol, great show. SDI 440. Somehow Paul Kimball didn't seem half as narcissistic as usual. He sounded serious about the UFO subject, something I'd never heard from him before, and he actually seemed interested in what others in his film had to say. Again, something I'd never heard before in one of his extended interviews. He was darn close to charming. That's one damn fine interview of Paul Kimball in my book. The only part of it is that it seemed out of place when he said he'd wished he'd been born in Jennifer Alba's body. I'd have thought someone as knowledgeable about film and the classics and possessing that particular lifestyle choice would have preferred being Fay Wray. But what the hell do I know? In all seriousness, and after listening to Alfred's commentary, I'd have to admit Kimball was pretty darn close to being reasonable on the program. I'm eating crow. I agree with Alfred. Kimball seemed bright, sincere, and I liked what he said about the thinking behind his documentary. He sounded as though he had no motive other than laying out the truth and trying to eke out a living in what must be an impossibly tough business. That gets my respect, and unless he commits some future digital atrocity, I'm a new Kimball doc watcher, and I don't even care if the guy wants to grow up to be Jessica Alba. There are worse things in life than becoming a cross-dressing UFO documentarian. You could end up contributing to the Republican Party, or worse, becoming a schoolteacher. Terrific interview, great show. I agree with both your guests. The program is super as a podcast, better than ever. Best, Bubba. And thank you, Bubba, for your email. And how about you? SDI at virtuallystrange.net.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
Some of the discussions and posts that have been going on in the UFO updates list has me scratching my head. I can't figure it out, and it befuddles me whenever I try, because there are some people involved in ufology that have such a strong belief system, they would make some theologians envious. Now, I'm not saying that having a belief system is a bad thing. I personally believe in a number of things purely on faith, and every single religion on the planet has evolved from a series of beliefs that cannot be proven or disproven. But what makes me scratch my head is when somebody shows that they believe in something so strongly, they either do not examine evidence showing opposite point of view, or they just say that the real evidence supporting their claim has been tampered with or removed or otherwise embroiled in some conspiracy. Now, when it comes to UFOs, a certain amount of belief has to come into play because ufologists have not yet gotten their hands on an alien ashtray or some other artifact that can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that UFOs are intelligently piloted craft from some other world. In the television series The X-Files, there was a poster in Agent Fox Mulder's office showing one of Billy Mier's photographs with the caption, "The truth is out there," underneath. And that's true. The truth is out there. But we have to keep searching for it when it comes to ufology. I believe that we are not alone in the universe, and that there are other planets out there that are inhabited by intelligent, technological creatures that may or may not look similar to us. I also believe that some of those civilizations could be vastly superior to us in technology and capable of doing things that our scientists claim cannot be done. But beyond those things that I believe, there are things I would like to be true. For example, I really would have loved it if the alien autopsy film had proven to be the real thing, or it was true that if I used a high-powered flashlight, I'd be able to signal UFOs and have them land in my backyard. But these things are not true, and they have been shown to be, what's the correct diplomatic term? Oh, yeah, falsehoods. I would even love to learn that Men in Black and Men in Black 2 were documentary films produced by a movie studio from another planet. But guess what? They're not. They're very entertaining pieces of fiction. I think part of my problem with all of this is that recently I found myself enjoying watching various episodes of CSI. And although that also is a fictional television show, it's based on something that happens in real life with real-life crime scene investigation units. The one thing that is constant and true about both CSI the television series and CSI the real thing is that they both have to dispassionately follow the trail of evidence regardless of where it leads them. I guess what it boils down to is that I like to think that all ufologists are like those people that I respect in ufology. Stanton Friedman, Kevin Randall, Dick Hall, David Rudiak, Gildas Bourdais, just to name a few. Although they have done a lot of research into various UFO cases, they have come to some conclusions that they are not capable of proving, beyond a shadow of a doubt, what they believe. However, they have also done everything in their power to try and find some other evidence that proves they are wrong. And you will gladly look at whatever somebody brings forward. You see, I may believe in something, but if somebody comes forward and shows me that what I believe is wrong, I may get a little angry about it. I may even throw a hissy fit about it. But when it all boils down to it, I will accept the proof. I'll tuck my tail between my legs and go home. I will not beat my chest and yell loudly that I am right, and ask the people not to try and confuse me with the facts. Sometimes, being able to recognize the facts is what makes the difference between somebody involved in ufology being recognized as a ufologist or as a saucer head. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Nice analogy, Dave Furlong.
Thank you.
With CSI.
Yeah, the show is very good, but the reality is, like, CSI investigations don't get ended at that hour, but they do take their time to get through stuff. They have to look at the evidence, and only the evidence. They can't turn around and assume, okay, this guy is guilty, and now let's try and prove him guilty. And in some situations, that's what we're having with in the field of ufology. Somebody is going, this is the way that is, and I don't accept anything else. And it's like, no. You've got all this evidence over here, pal. Look at this. This proves that that could not possibly have happened.
Obsessive behavior, some might term it.
in a lot of ways, it is very obsessive. The people just are refusing. It's like Stanton says, don't confuse me with the facts. We've got a lot of facts out there. When we find the facts, we have to accept it, whether we like them or not. That's the truth of the matter.
And we've talked about this so many times on the program now,
mm-hmm.
about obsessive-compulsive behavior. And I'm certainly no psychoanalyst, I'm not a psychiatrist, and neither am I a physicist. But when you look at the evidence, even from your point of view or my point of view, or, you know, the seriously interested, you have to say, okay, enough is enough. We can't keep going back over and over. Here's the evidence. This is what we've concluded from the existing evidence. There's no further evidence available. Let's move on.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the main trick, too. It's, okay, this particular case, whatever it be, we've come to this conclusion so far. That doesn't mean that we're not open to looking at new evidence, but that is the key. New evidence.
New evidence, yes. Oh, please let there be new evidence on several of the cases that have been discussed on the UFO updates over the years.
Oh, I really would love to see some of it. The thing that bugs me is I'm sure there is some new evidence out there that hasn't been discovered yet, or, to be quite frank, is being hidden.
As always, Dave Frelott, a great take, and I'm always grateful for you when you point out the fallibilities of others and not mine.
Also my own fallibilities, yes. I might add.
Hey, we'll talk to you next week, Dave Frelott.
For sure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The last couple of times that Stuart Miller has been on, he has mentioned Dr. David Clark in several contexts, and I figured that it would be a good idea, since we've talked about Dr. David Clark on the program in the past, to bring David Clark to your ears. So joining us on the phone from his home in Sheffield, England, is Dr. David Clark. He's written many books, including Out of the Shadows, UFOs, The Establishment, and the official cover-up with Andy Roberts, The UFOs That Never Were with Jenny Randles and Andy Roberts, and Phantoms of the Sky, UFOs, A Modern Myth, again with Andy Roberts. So joining us on the phone from his home in Sheffield, England, is Dr. David Clark. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you.
It's about time, after 8 years and your many years on the UFO updates list and other lists and forums, and now with your own website, drdavidclark.co.uk.
I was reflecting upon this only recently about how long I'd actually been involved in the subject, and it's quite worrying, really. Most of my adult life. I mean, the time that I can sort of think back to when I first became interested in UFOs, I must have been a teenager, sort of certainly 14 or 15 years old, when I went to see the Close Encounters of the Third Kind when it was on general release over here in England, which I think must have been the spring or summer of 1978. And I remember being very, very spaced out by seeing the film, and after that point, I was more and more curious about UFOs, and I wanted to know, you know, what lay behind the premise of the film. And I distinctly remember later that year, in December, family used to sit around and watch the late news before we went to bed, and I remember the newscaster, the top item on the news at 10, which was most unusual for English TV, and it was a UFO story, and it was the famous film of the UFOs taken by the Argosy airline over New Zealand on New Year's Eve 1978. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, I saw that film, it was fantastic, and this seems to suggest that, you know, the film was fiction, but obviously something is going on, and we are being visited by something. So from that point onwards, I think I can trace the growth of my interest in the subject. And I distinctly remember afterwards in the new year going to the city and basically trying to buy just about every paperback book I could find that had the letters UFO on there. So that was the genesis of my interest, and I've never been able to escape right up to the present.
Mm. Are you like me? Do you still play with your mashed potatoes and make Devil's Tour?
Yes, I do sometimes, I must admit, much to the annoyance of my partner.
That movie, that film, had a similar impact on me, too. You have investigated or looked into many cases in the time that you've been involved with UFOs. Your favorite?
My favorite case? Recently, I've been asked by 14 Times, where I write a monthly column, Flying Sorcery with Andy Roberts, to contribute to their 60th anniversary issue, which I believe is out in July. And one of the things we were asked to produce was a list of our top 10 favourite cases. And I know Paul Kimball has done a similar thing for his recent TV documentary. And this case I picked out as the one that I think is probably the most impressive and certainly unexplained is the close encounter at Livingston in Scotland in November 1979, which is the one where the forestry worker, Mr. Robert Taylor, who recently died, unfortunately, he was out in the forest, he turned into a clearing and saw this huge dome-shaped semi-transparent object sitting there in the woods. He was then approached by two smaller objects, which looked something like wartime mines, which seemed to drop from the larger object. These approached him, both on each side of him. He lost consciousness, and the next thing he knew, I think he woke up about 20 minutes later. His dog was barking. He had this horrible taste in his mouth. Dragged himself home. Police were called. He was examined by a doctor. They found traces at the site, and it's never explained, and it's still sitting there on the Lothian police case file as an unexplained incident all these years later. And he's never changed his story. There's been various attempts to find a rational explanation, some of them more fantastic than the idea that he saw an alien spacecraft, I've got to say. And that is the one case that I remember from that period when I first became interested in UFOs that I believe has never been adequately explained. So I would pick that out as a favorite. There are many other similar incidents that I find inexplicable, and that's the reason why I'm still involved, even though I'm very skeptical.
I've noticed your skepticism over the years. I want to stick with the Scottish case for a moment. All of the documentation on that case by the Lothian police presumably has been archived somewhere, yes?
That's a very interesting point, because quite recently now we've got the Freedom of Information Act in the UK. You can now make requests to the police and to the Ministry of Defence, various other places, which you weren't able to do in the past. And I recently made an FOI to Lothian for their case file on this, and they told me that everything had been destroyed, that they'd not retained any of the documents from their investigation at the time. And that is quite typical of the authorities here. We often only preserve statements and evidence where it's not directly related to a serious criminal incident. It's often destroyed after a set period of time, usually a couple of years, sometimes 5 years. Luckily, in this case, it's one of the few cases that was thoroughly and properly investigated by a UFO association at the time it happened. And in this case, it was Bufora. I'm not sure what their status is at the moment, but certainly at that time, in the 70s and 80s, they had a very, very good system of investigators, a network that covered the entire country. And in this case, Stuart Campbell, very much a UFO skeptic, he did actually do a very, very good, thorough and objective investigation of this incident, and his case report was published by Bufora. And in the case report, fortunately, he managed to obtain copies of the Livingston CID documents relating to this particular case, including a signed statement by Robert Taylor given to the police, a forensic report, all kinds of things, and they were all collated in this report. Now, it's not available on the internet, unfortunately, or direct paper copy. There's very few copies of this report in circulation, and I feel it's one of the best that was done at the time. But again, this is a problem that needs to be addressed by ufology, that there is lots of material such as this that isn't widely available. And if it's not on the internet, it doesn't tend to exist in a lot of people's minds, which is unfortunate.
What you're saying is that the only copy of the stuff that was found during the course of the investigation is lodged with BUFORA, the British UFO Research Association?
Yeah, it's an appendix in Stuart Campbell's report that he prepared for the BUFORA, which was published by them in 1980 or 1981. It's just it's no longer in print, which is unfortunate.
And I wonder who has copies of the original publication?
Very few ufologists. Mm-hmm. I only recently obtained a copy of it from another ufologist who preserved it. I just find it's unfortunate that so much attention is given to what I deem to be very poor UFO cases, and good ones such as this are very little known and very little discussed. I think that's partly as a result of the fact that this subject has got such a large back catalogue that lots of material is overlooked, and lots of material that was published in the past, which is not available online, tends to be overlooked, which is unfortunate.
Are you likely to put up your copy of that case on your new website?
I'm not sure who the copyright belongs to. I do understand, though, that BUFORA have got an ongoing program of scanning their publications and past case files for release onto their website. I'm not sure what their current status is, because quite recently they said that they were cancelling their public lectures, that they were no longer having a magazine, and that they were going to be entirely internet-based, which seems to be the way that much of ufology is conducted in the present day. So I'm hoping that at some stage Stuart's report will turn up on their website.
BUFORA has been inactive of late. There doesn't seem to be much going on at their website. There are very few researchers who were involved with BUFORA, the British UFO Research Association, who put BUFORA after their names anymore.
I served for some time as a BUFORA council member, and if I go back to what I originally said about my involvement, I think I must have been one of the youngest investigators for BUFORA. I mean, I remember writing to Jenny Randalls, must have been 1980 to 1981, to say, please, could I be an investigator? And I must have been no more than 15 or 16 years old at the time. At that time, BUFORA and Contact UK, which was the other big organisation in the UK, were ufology, but ufology was practiced in a very different way back in the 70s and the 80s. Again, I keep coming back to the internet, and I think it's the internet that has changed the way things are done. I don't think people are all that bothered anymore about joining a very large organisation and subscribing to a magazine. I think they much prefer to sit at home and surf the internet. They can get all the information that they feel they need via that method, and I think there's a lot of cynicism that people don't want to belong to an organisation. I don't know whether that's reflected in North America, is it? Do you have the same problems?
Very much so, yes. The Mutual UFO Network of Ontario here did basically what BUFORA was doing in order to increase membership and to increase the number of people who would become seriously involved with the organisation and actually go out and do the investigation, do the research.
Mm.
And they would hold monthly meetings, and 40, 50 people show up. But they weren't interested in becoming involved with the organization. They wanted to be entertained for their $5 admission.
That's a key point. That really is. And I think a lot of people, certainly with the investigators and the people who are involved in serious research, I think the money that is paid for subscriptions, and certainly with BUFORA, I mean, there's an R in the acronym BUFORA, which relates to research. And I think there was a lot of cynicism that monies that were being paid to join a research organisation, what was actually being spent on research and investigation? Most of the funds seem to be going into entertaining people in the way that you've just said, putting on a public lectures, putting out a publication. And that's okay when there's a lot of public interest in the subject of UFOs, when the subject's high in the media, when there are films, etc., etc. But as soon as interest drops away, as it has done since the 50th anniversary, and there's less media interest, there's less sightings of any note, and I think that's when the big organisations tend to start having problems, and that has obviously impacted on BUFORA in a big way.
As has the internet. People are very happy to download their email from whatever list they're subscribed to, and with their tea or coffee go through that, and that's the extent of their serious interest.
It's a double-edged sword in that the internet is pretty useful in that nowadays, when there's a big sighting like the one over O'Hare Airport comes along, you get instantly all the information that's available is available to everybody across the world. I mean, in the past, you would have to wait months to receive information. People would be using typewriters and knocking together newsletters, and it would take a long, long time for information to filter around. And on the internet, it's there immediately. But the other side, it does tend to dumb down ufology, I think, in some respects, in that you just get endless arguments rather than actually saying, right, let's do something and let's go out and interview someone. It's very easy to sit at a keyboard and argue with somebody via email, but if you are really serious about getting to the bottom of mysteries, the best thing to do is to pick the phone up and do some real investigations, and that is what I've tried to do. I've tried to cut through all the tiresome arguments between skeptics and believers that just go on and on and on, and actually say to myself, right, if something needs resolving, the best way to do it is to go out and do a proper investigation. And being a journalist, which is the profession I went into, that to me is quite a natural thing to do. I'm used to picking up the phone and tracking people down. I'm used to bothering the authorities and being persistent and not going away when they tell me to go away. And I suppose that's why I've ended up looking at the aspects of ufology that I have.
You have a PhD, yes?
I do, yes.
So your PhD is in what?
It's in folklore and cultural tradition. I studied at Sheffield University part-time. It took me around 10 years to complete. The relevance of that is that Sheffield University is the only university in England, not in the UK, there are similar bodies in Wales and Scotland, where you can actually study folklore to PhD or MPhil level. The whole centre is unique. It's got an archive of material that stretches back to the mid-1960s, a very large library, and a very thriving teaching schedule, and lots and lots of postgraduate students who are conducting research into folklore-related areas. So I've got this dual background in that I studied archaeology originally for my degree and followed that up by doing a PhD in folklore, but at the same time, to earn a crust, I was working as a journalist, so put me in a unique position to look at contentious claims such as the ones that I've been interested in. And you'll see, if you look at my website, that UFOs is just one area of the supernatural or the paranormal, whatever you want to call it, that yeah. I've been interested in. I've written books on the more traditional supernatural themes, such as ghosts and legends, and I've also written a book quite recently on the First World War legend of the Angel of Mons, which has got many crossovers with UFOs, not in direct terms, but in the way that people believed that the British Army had been saved by angels, a vision in the sky that was seen over the battlefield. And I investigated that in great detail, both historically and by tracking down people who had some memory of that, and tried my best to get to the bottom of the mystery. And at the end of the day, a large question mark still remained.
Well, it's much like Fatima or Fatima in Portugal.
Exactly, yeah.
The evidence is in the eye of the beholder, so British troops saw angels, and the three children at Fatima in Portugal saw the Virgin Mary.
Mm. Mm. The problem with the Fatima case is that we do know who the witnesses were, and there's little doubt that they did have some kind of mysterious or supernatural experience. What I found with the Angel of Mons story was that it had been portrayed by the media at the time and in lots of subsequent books that there were numerous witnesses, i.e. soldiers, who had testified to having seen angels at the time. But when I actually investigated this in great depth, which involved lots and lots of research in newspapers, tracing written statements, etc., etc., I was unable to find a single named witness who'd actually reported seeing something that could be described as an angel at the time. So to me, it turned out to be more of a story, an urban legend, rather than a real event. I did actually find someone in the end. He died by the time I reached him, but there was a recording that he'd made at the age of 101, who was in one of the Ulster regiments, who'd actually been interviewed by a BBC reporter in the 1980s, and he described seeing a figure of a man holding a flaming sword emerge from a cloud during the midst of a battle. But because I was unable to speak to him directly, and the story was a bit ambiguous to say the least, that was the nearest I came in the case of the Angel of Mons to actually finding a first-hand witness. But you do have to bear in mind that I was looking into this many, many years after the events, and that many of the people who were there at the time had died, but the strange thing is none of them had left an unambiguous statement about what they'd seen.
I wonder if those witnesses had actually officially reported, and if there was an official report about it all at some point, whether they had the time to do it, you know, with what was going on, the Battle of Mons and subsequent battles. And you have to wonder if perhaps there was an official report that disappeared.
Well, there was allegedly one of the senior officers, a brigadier general in the intelligence corps, had actually recorded something about the visions that were supposedly seen in his contemporary diary. All his papers and his diaries were archived in London. And although he published a book in the 1930s saying that he'd made this entry in his diary at the time about these angels, when I actually tracked down the original diary itself, the entries that he claimed he'd made were not there. And to me, putting together all the evidence, it suggested that he had rewritten the diary entries. He admits this in the book he wrote in 1931, and he'd added his memory, subsequent memory, from what he'd read in newspapers and what he'd heard from people, in the rewritten entries from his original notes. So, again, that seemed to rule out what he'd actually said at the time as being something that was definitively contemporary. So this is the problems you face when you're trying to reconstruct, you know, what actually happened.
I guess in a way it's similar to Roswell, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and you really do have to be very, very careful in how you interpret people's memories as opposed to actual definitive contemporary records from the time. We do know from the time of Roswell, obviously, that something did happen, but the dispute is over what precisely that was.
And ongoing, too.
Mm. I don't know there's any doubt that the alien autopsy event is a hoax. I think with Roswell, I'd just prefer to suspend judgment, although my natural inclination is to believe that something did happen, certainly, but I bet it was something connected with some top-secret experiment that went wrong.
Well, as Nick Redfern said in his book, testing balloons and flying wings using poor sods from captured Japanese units.
Yes, that's the case. I mean, I distinctly remember back in the late 1980s, John Keel coming over to give us a talk here in Sheffield for our independent UFO network, and the talk he gave was on the Japanese Fugo balloons. I think he was trying to imply that one of these balloons had perhaps crashed at Roswell, and although we know that's not the case, there is this connection with balloons, that the one that Nick Redfern has recently resurrected. I'm not entirely convinced by that explanation, but it seems to me from the descriptions at the time, and that is what you've got to go on, the contemporary descriptions of what was found does seem to fit with some kind of balloon. You can argue and argue and argue, but you cannot get away from that. And unless somebody comes forward with some more definitive evidence, and I'm sorry, but people's testimony given 20, 30, 40 years later isn't evidence. It's evidence of something, but it's not contemporary evidence, does not convince.
I'm actually puzzled by the United States Air Force's final word on the Roswell case that came out coincidentally with the 50th anniversary 10 years ago, stating that what people saw were the parachute test dummies. There must be paperwork or a paper trail that goes back to that time, which they could have surely pulled out and said, look, here's the paperwork, here's the balloon flights, here's what was recovered, and on the days that were recovered from the various flights. But they haven't done that.
I can see the point. I mean, I'm not convinced at all that these crash test dummies had anything to do with the Roswell incident, but I can also sympathize with the position that the United States Air Force find themselves in that whatever they produce, I mean, and you can draw parallels here with the British Ministry of Defence as well, there is this suspicion that they aren't being straight with people, that they're hiding something. And it just seems to me that whatever they produce, whatever documents they turn out, it's not going to be enough, because unless it provides the evidence to the people who believe that Roswell was an ET crash, then it's not going to be accepted. People are always going to be finding contradictions and picking holes. It just seems to me that we assume that the government, because it's the government, must know the answers to everything. And it's very, very disappointing to some people, seemingly, that when it turns out they don't, that they haven't got any evidence, that there is nothing, that whatever it once existed no longer exists. People find that difficult to believe. I find it quite straightforward. If they don't honestly know the answer, they're being pressed to give an answer, all they can do is the same that we do if we're doing research. We go to the sources that exist. And if the sources don't provide the answer, then there's not really much more that can be said. As far as I can see, it's an honest opinion based upon what evidence survives, which is not much.
You mentioned the Ministry of Defense in the UK, and Dr. David Clark has been a huge thorn in the side of the Ministry of Defense with his Freedom of Information requests. N'est-ce pas?
Yeah, oh, certainly, yeah. The background to that lies in two different areas. Firstly, as a journalist, I teach student journalists. That's part of what I do at Sheffield Hallam University. And the course I teach is journalistic research techniques, which includes how to use the Data Protection Act, how to use the Freedom of Information Act, etc., etc. So obviously I wanted to practice this myself rather than just teaching the subject. And it seemed quite obvious for me quite early on, even before we had a Freedom of Information Act here in the UK, that one way to test all these stories about that there's a government cover-up in this country, in Britain I'm talking about here, would be to use this new legislation and to find out what really is known, get to the bottom of some of the claims that have been made about the Ministry of Defence and its involvement in the subject. So right from the late 1990s, I had a double-pronged programme, both of going to the National Archives in London, where lots of material had already been released under the 30-year rule. And also, there was a precursor to the Freedom of Information Act called the Code of Practice for Access to Government Information. And I started just putting in tentative requests under that, and that was an arrangement whereby historians or interested people could apply for access to government documents, and they would look at them, and if they thought there wasn't anything contentious, that they would release them. And the first thing I turned my attention to was the Rendlesham Forest incident, which is continuing controversy almost on par with Roswell on this side of the Atlantic. And there was always this suggestion that the British government or the MOD knew a lot more about the incident than what they were saying, and that they said that they only had one document, which was Colonel Holt's memo. Now, we knew that they'd done some kind of assessment in order to reach the conclusion that this case was of, quote, no defence significance.